You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the program today, the rising American dollar in a very microeconomic sense, millennials and food economics, and our series Your Economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this 11th day of March, everybody. The relevant economic statistic on this Wednesday comes to us from the foreign exchange markets. It is $1.05. That's what you have to pay to get 1 euro were you traveling today. It's very nearly a 12-year low for the single currency. Or, if you put it another way, and this might be more helpful, the dollar is stronger than it's been in a dozen years. That means you can buy more yen, more euros, even more Canadian dollars, should you so choose, with your American greenbacks. But if you're not in the habit of buying foreign currencies for fun, and really you ought not be, so what? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more on what the strengthening dollar means for you and me and a guy named Bill from California.
In his free time, Bill Kendrick likes to work on his 1983 Atari computer. Right now, he's eyeing some cartridge from a fellow hobbyist in Poland that costs about 40 euro.
So back in 2008, the last one I bought that was also about 40 euro, that came out to about $55. And today it's coming out to about $41, $42.
He saves over 20%, which means
an easier sell to my wife who does the budget.
Also, many big American retailers like Target or Kohl's buy goods overseas. A stronger dollar makes those products less expensive. But Dan Morris with TIAA Craft Asset Management says not all companies will pass those savings on to customers. And if they do, it'll likely be with the higher end goods.
So it's more likely to be noticeable, say, an imported car than the price of an imported pair of tennis shoes.
The money we spend abroad will also go further. This Saturday, you could get a room at the Hotel Regina in Paris for 220 euro. That's about $230.
In 2014, a 220 euro hotel would have cost you a little over $300.
Boris Sloshberg at BK Asset Management says it's a great time to make a trip to Europe. He's watched the dollar shoot up against the euro. But he says what goes up comes down.
Good times may last for maybe 6 months or more, but maybe not.
Yes, Hotel Regina? I'd like to book a room, please. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The police chief in Ferguson, Missouri has decided to step down. Thomas Jackson was the focus of much of the discussion and the unrest that followed the shooting death of Michael Brown this past summer. The resignation comes after a scathing report from the Department of Justice in which Attorney General Eric Holder said, among a good many other things, that Ferguson used its police force and its ticketing power as a revenue source. Can they possibly be the only city to do that? Marketplace's Nova Sappho looked into it.
Go ahead, I dare you, walk up to people in the street and ask them if police quotas exist. Try Los Angeles.
I believe they do have quotas. That's their main incentive.
Probably 90% of them. I don't have any statistics to back that up.
Well, at least half. They got to make money.
So do they exist? I called up law professor Beth Colgan at UCLA, who studies the issue. And she says, well,
there are different bits of evidence here and there, but I don't know of any sort of empirical analysis.
She says that's because our law enforcement system is decentralized and no one's measured what's happening everywhere. But there are clues.
If you look at the criminal and civil codes in any county or state, as a general matter, the use of fines and fees and costs is something that's pervasive around the country.
In Chicago, for instance, red light cameras reportedly generate $70 million in fines a year. And the tiny town of Randolph, Missouri, got into trouble a few years ago when the state found out that the town's budget came almost exclusively from highway traffic fines.
The problem here is really one of incentives.
Brian Jackson heads the Safety and Justice Program at the Rand Corporation. He says fines help local governments shore up budget holes, but he says a lot of municipalities haven't been careful about the potential consequences.
The question comes down to, you know, sort of how much is too much, and at what point does that start distorting the decisions of individual officers?
And the bigger question, says Jackson, is whether voters are willing to fund services their local governments provide through taxes instead. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Given the past couple of days, Wall Street was pretty tame today, truth be told. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We don't eat like we used to. By and large, that's a good thing for us. Less packaged and processed food. Equally, by and large, it's not so good for the companies that make processed and packaged foods. Marketplace's Annie Baxter went to find out who the customers are who are driving that.
Sales have been slumping for a whole bunch of processed food companies. Whether it's General Mills, Kraft, or the Campbell Soup Company, some of their top brands are struggling. Campbell's chief executive Denise Morrison recently acknowledged these difficulties pretty frankly at a conference. She cited an explosion of interest in fresh food.
And along with this, as all of you know, has come a mounting distrust of so-called big food, the large food companies and legacy brands on which millions of consumers have relied on for so long.
One of the people participating in that backlash is 23-year-old Nick Nealon.
Would you ever use a term like big food?
Yes, and I would also use a term like evil and the devil and Lucifer.
I found Nealon stirring a pot of homemade polenta at a Minneapolis event called Eat for Equity. People raise money for charities while sharing a big, healthy meal.
The food is ready if you want to grab a plate and get started.
A mushroom and fennel ragu fills the air with a rich tomatoey scent. Nealon says that's his kind of grub. He avoids packaged and fast foods.
Somebody else made it, don't eat it. Generally, you'll be happier if you cook all your food from scratch.
Food and beverage analyst Darren Seifer with the NPD Group says young people in particular are rebelling against processed food.
What we found, particularly with the millennial generation, is that they are opting a bit more for fresh items, so things like fruits and vegetables, even some meats.
Seifer traces the change to the Great Recession. Young people ate out less often because they were broke. And instead of cracking open a can of Chef Boyardee, some learned how to cook.
And a lot of that, I think, has to do with how millennials got used to their kitchen sooner than we expected them to.
Food analyst Alexia Howard at Bernstein says another demographic is playing a big role, too. Women.
Over the last several decades, really since the Second World War, heavily processed or packaged foods, more convenient foods, were embraced by moms at home and women wanting to get into the workforce.
But Howard says a few years ago, sales of products like Jell-O and TV dinners declined noticeably. Her theory? Moms were spending more time on the internet reading about what goes into food and got turned off by additives and preservatives. Heidi Stark, who's 37, is a case in point.
I mean, when you start reading what's actually in the packages, no one wants it.
I tagged along with Stark during a grocery shopping trip in Minneapolis. Her 7-year-old son, Anderson, was also in tow, trying to score some junk food, unsuccessfully.
I want pudding.
No.
Stark says gut problems prompted her to start eating super healthy over the past year. Now, she plans out her menu and buys lots of fresh fruits, veggies, and meat, sometimes to Anderson's chagrin.
Pork chops with apples and shallots.
Sounds gross.
And then just a sirloin Dijon with kale mixed into
that
it.
That sounds gross, too.
Packaged food companies are trying to woo back consumers like Heidi Stark with some fresh products, like baby carrots from the Campbell Soup Company, or protein-packed items like a Kraft snack pack with meat, cheese, and nuts. Some are also appealing to the growing interest in simple organic ingredients. Think General Mills' acquisition of Annie's, which makes organic mac and cheese. Stock analyst Alexia Howard says even if these products sell well, they're still a small part of the company's overall business.
The margins on these new products are a lot lower. The growth in these new products, rapid though it is, they're starting from a much smaller base than the bigger established brands.
While these big food companies struggle to meet the needs of millennials and moms who want fresher foods, Howard says we could see more cost-cutting and even consolidation. In Minneapolis, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Austin, Texas is for some pretty much the center of the universe for the next couple of weeks. South by Southwest is in session starting on Friday. I'll be there talking about news and social media on a panel. But before the tech crowd and the film buffs and the music lovers descend on that fair city, South by Southwest education is going on right now, which is where we've dialed up Marketplace's Adrian Hill. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, Guy.
So how is it? What's it like?
Well, we're getting things ready for you. Here's what I'd say. There are signs going up. There are tents going up. But this is really the calm before the booze-filled extravaganza
hey.
That you are about to step foot in.
I don't think a couple of beers is a booze-filled extravaganza. You've been there, what, 3-4 days now, yeah?
I have.
What are you seeing that the rest of us are going to see pretty soon coming to our kids' classrooms?
Well, for people who are in school districts that haven't handed out computers or tablets to mm-hmm. every kid, there's a sense that that day is coming soon for everyone. Here's Tom Leonard. He's superintendent of Eanes Independent School District here in Austin.
Technology in schools right now is like the infancy of the automobile. For a while, when the automobile was just starting, the horse was more effective. It really was. But we knew we were going in the direction of the car, so we had to get there. And right now I think that's what's happening in classrooms. And you're seeing teachers struggle with that somewhat, but good school districts know we need to get there, and we'll get there.
So long, horses. This is happening all over the country in all kinds of districts. And tech entrepreneurs are fighting to get into the classroom and really on those machines and make money from that.
Yeah, I think we're mostly at my kids' schools. I think we're mostly in the horse phase. I mean, right? they're trying, but they're not quite there yet. What about the kids? What are kids doing now, you know?
Well, there is a trend here. There's a whole lot of making going on, and basically products that are sort of the technification of toys. We're talking about doodling in 3D, really, really elaborate Lego robots, and of course, Kai, coding.
Yeah.
A lot of coding. Here's teacher Claire Novi from Miami.
Coding is now pushing down into the lower grades. We're talking kindergarten level.
Man. So, Kai, we might want to prepare for a world where your second grader is making apps.
She'd probably be pretty good at it. I don't even know. What else is there? I mean, it can't all be just, you know, like tech and toys and all that stuff, right?
It's not. One thing that's really interesting that's popped out to me is there's all this talk about kids' feelings and whether or not they feel like they fit in and feel like they belong. And there's interesting data showing that really matters as far as their performance goes. The Austin superintendent also told me about an interesting trend in teaching entrepreneurship to high schoolers, basically with the idea that this economy might not create jobs for them, so they're in the future going to have to create jobs for themselves. And then there are those really supremely practical things. Here's Dallas Dance, who's the superintendent of Baltimore County Schools.
Usually school systems have about 5 to 6 different systems they operate from. Your learning management system can be one, your grade book's another, your student information system's one. You may have a data dashboard or a warehouse somewhere else. We're creating BCPS1, which will be a one-stop shop for everyone.
Maybe a one-stop shop database is only the thing school superintendents can get excited about, but, you know, it's a big deal in the education world.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill from our Learning Curve team. She is down in Austin, Texas at South by Southwest EDU. Adrian, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Guy.
There is more of our daily coverage of South by. By the way, it's at marketplace.org. That includes our blog. It's called the Marketplace Daily Download. Check it out. Coming up.
Younger candidates who have taken no breaks in their career are being picked over the likes of candidates like me.
Our series, Your Economy, returns. But first, let's do the numbers. Man, I haven't heard this in a while. The Dow Industrial shed 27 points. That's about a 10%, closed at 17,635. See, you can still surprise me. The NASDAQ down 9 points, 0.2%, ended things at 48.49. The S&P 500 dipped 3 points, a 10%, finished at 20.40. Southwest Airlines flew up 2%. Today, the carrier said its flights were more crowded and said a key revenue figure increased last month. And retail clothing store Express put on 3.5% today after reporting fourth quarter results that beat expectations. Apple ducked down 1.8% after a rare outage hit its iTunes and app stores, frustrating millions of users around the world, including moi. Try to get some meerkat going. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.10%, or just 2.1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department is scheduled to issue its monthly statement for February. The Commerce Department reports on retail sales for February. And on March 12, 1951, the comic strip Dennis the Menace debuted. And he's still making trouble today. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The earthquake and subsequent tsunami and ensuing nuclear meltdown that we have come to collectively refer to as Fukushima was 4 years ago today. Thousands of people were killed. The contamination could last 300 years. And so today, Japan has gone cold turkey on nuclear energy. There are no plants online right now over there. Solar is filling a small part of Japan's energy gap. But like any power source on the planet, solar comes with costs and with benefits. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Japan's solar market has grown tenfold the last 2 years. The government threw $7 billion in subsidies at the sector, says Justin Wu of Bloomberg New Energy Finance in Asia. He spoke by Skype.
The Japanese consumer seems to have really opened up to solar, putting solar panels on their rooftops, in homes, but also in commercial retail areas.
The rising sun power story is a global one, aided by cheaper, more efficient solar panels. Then in Japan came the pushback. Utilities controlling the grid system said, enough, we won't take any more solar energy. There are technical trade-offs, says engineering professor Masuda Min at the University of Minnesota.
That can actually damage the equipment and make electromechanical devices at the substations malfunction. So the grid is not ready for it.
It is fixable. The complex solution is what some call a smart grid, but it comes with its own trade-off.
All of this requires an enormous amount of investment.
Paul Scalise studies Asian energy issues at the University of Duisburg-Essen in Germany. He spoke by Skype, too.
And the question always comes up, who is going to pay for it? Will it be the government? Will it be the power company? Or will it be the consumer?
These clean energy questions face not just Japan, but Germany, Spain, Australia, California. But in Tokyo, inaction yields yet another trade-off, the environment. Without nuclear energy, Japanese rely more and more on fossil fuels. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Last year saw a record performance by hedge funds, only not in a good way. Average returns pretty much scraped the bottom of the performance graph. Funds closed up shop right and left, and big investors pulled out almost as fast. Not that that's necessarily a reason to be sympathetic, because the whole point of a hedge fund, remember, is less regulation and less scrutiny in exchange for catering to the mostly really well-off. Okay, to the rich. There are those in that business, though, who want to change the hedge fund paradigm. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn has the story of one of them.
Hedge fund manager. If those words call up an image, it might be a gray-haired man in a tailored suit with no tie, standing in an office full of dark wood, making bold predictions and billions of dollars. We'll add to that Howard Wong.
Let me quickly then show you over here.
In sweatpants at a desk next to his bed, scrolling through ticker symbols.
Every single one of these is a position that we hold. For example, this is Apple, right, and Amazon.
Stocks and bonds, but from every market in the world, plus currencies, commodities, futures. When we're looking at this list of 200 different positions, if people are thinking, what's a hedge fund? That's it, right? This is the hedge fund.
Yep, that is literally the hedge fund.
You know, I think you could just as easily call it a private investment fund in that it's privately offered and you don't advertise to bring in investors.
Steve Nadell is a hedge fund lawyer, and he says despite the name, they're not necessarily hedged. What these pools of money are is private, lightly regulated, and open only to the super rich. Traditionally, hedge fund managers also share a method of charging those investors, a management fee of 2 cents out of every dollar invested, and a performance fee of 20 cents out of every dollar gained. But that's changed a bit since the financial crisis.
You go back pre-2008, just about every hedge fund had a 2% management fee. Right now, the average fee is around 1.7%.
Wong's fund, Convoy Investments, is trying 1.25% with discounts for early investors.
And no performance fees.
And does that pay the rent?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it depends on how much money we're managing. Right now, it does not pay the rent. For the last few years, I've been basically working out of my own savings.
It's a thrifty approach that might appeal to investors fed up not just with the fees, but with the returns they've been getting in exchange.
When speaking about returns, one word that I've heard a lot is, you know, mediocre.
Melissa Santinello is one of the founders of AOI, a group of some 250 hedge fund investors. Last year, they put out a kind of aspirational hedge fund investor bill of rights, including fees that would be lower during bad years.
It's just aligning their interests. It's just making it a little bit more fair.
And making it a better deal. Simon Lack wrote The Hedge Fund Mirage. He compared the returns from investing in the average hedge fund to investing in a standard boring 60-40 mix of stock and bond index funds. And starting in 2002, he says hedge funds lost every single year. That's before, during, and after the financial crisis.
It really sort of undercuts the whole rationale for having hedge funds in a portfolio. You know, I mean, if they're always going to underperform, always, what's the point?
Lack says the reason for that underperformance isn't just the high fees. It's that while the amount of money invested in hedge funds has more than doubled in the last decade, the number of opportunities to profit hasn't kept up.
Below $1 trillion in assets, hedge funds were able to generate reasonably good returns. And as they went above $1 trillion, that turned out to be too much money for the available opportunity set.
But for Howard Wong, this is just another part of his pitch. He's making a Skype call from his couch to a potential investor in Louisiana.
Hello.
Hi, David.
On that call, he sounds less like he's selling a hedge fund than one of those boring index funds. He says he will not be the genius manager who beats the market day to day. It's too competitive. He will not be making predictions. It's too hard to do consistently. Instead, his strategy is mostly passive, mostly automated, and mostly transparent.
You know, I'm basically just the guy that's going out there and executing on this strategy for you.
It's a pretty modest pitch, but it works.
I'm satisfied.
With this investor's $500,000, Wong's fund now stands at around $18 million. His discounted fees, minus auditors, lawyers, taxes, and split with his partner.
It comes out to be maybe $40,000 per person that we can take home, $30,000.
Which is not exactly what you think of as like a hedge fund salary.
Right, right. But we're okay with that.
He says it's worth it to run a fund of his own and to run it a little bit differently. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
The business and economic press of late, present company included, has been all about the big things. The coming interest rate hike, the European mess, the national labor picture. But all of that doesn't really amount to a hill of beans if the economy doesn't feel right to you. So for the past couple of months, we've been asking you to tell us about your economy. Today, it's Mohita Iyer from Santa Clara, California.
My husband and I have the story of a typical immigrant couple. We came to the U.S. for grad school to find love, work, and build a family in a country that offers so much. After marrying, we moved a few times from coast to coast, first for my job, then his, then decided we would put down roots in Silicon Valley, the seat of innovation and possibility. I'm a market research professional, or at least I was. I would have over 10 years of experience under my belt if I hadn't taken breaks in my career to have both my kids or help my second son, who has developmental delays, receive therapies 3 to 4 days a week. I didn't plan for most of this affecting my career, But after 2 years of searching for work that would help me, a professional with an advanced degree, find work that allows me to have some work-life balance, I've just given up. During interviews, I would get asked by younger women whether I thought I could handle the change in pace, but that's because they assumed being a full-time mother was less demanding. There is also the competition. Younger candidates who have taken no breaks in their career are being picked over the likes of candidates like me. It makes me wonder if employers who are seeking a less riskier version of me aren't also getting a less experienced one. Too many of us are being asked to deliver heaven and earth in order to get or keep our jobs for the privilege of company cafeterias and on-campus gyms. But tell me this, where do they want us to prioritize our families? I can't get back to work at the cost of my children's future. The statistics say the economy is improving, but to me, it feels like that improvement is slow enough to leave me behind.
Take a minute. Tell us the story of your economy. We'll put you on the radio. There's a place you can do it at our website. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which we mix popular culture, high tech, and metallurgy. The folks at Slate have been poring over Apple's patent applications for that watch you may have heard so much about. It turns out that Apple has invented a new way to make 18-karat gold for its top-of-the-line watches, the ones that go for $10,000 to $17,000. It's complicated, I'll admit that, and I am not a scientist, you guys know that, but apparently Apple does it by using something called gold metal matrix composite. It is still actual 18-karat gold if you're going to buy one of those things, but it lets the company, and this is a quote from its patent filing, use as little gold as possible, about which, of course, we've got a link to the Slate piece at our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
All right, that's all we've got today. The Dow off 27 points, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ down 9 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 dipped 3 points. That is a 10%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lanch, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Rayfield, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. And don't forget, this is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.